I'm Keith MacArthur. Unlocking Bryson's Brain is a podcast about my son.
Hi, Brian.
The rare disease that keeps him from walking or talking.
I mean, Bryson's perfect, but his life is really hard.
And our family's search for a cure.
Oh my gosh, maybe science is ready for this.
It's part memoir, part medical mystery.
We can do just about anything.
Modifying DNA.
My heart and my throat.
Cure is controversial.
Unlocking Bryson's Brain. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. This is White Coat Blackguard.
Right. Good afternoon. I'm Simon. I'll be flying you over to Ganges Salt Spring there. You can pass me your bags. And I'll either
Salt Spring, the largest of the Gulf Islands in the Georgia Strait, between Vancouver Island and the mainland. It's my first trip.
Let's go.
I like the Cookie Monster.
Cookie Monster because I once interviewed some kids at the hospital for sick children. And the hospital clown put the Cookie Monster on so I wouldn't scare the kids. It's been on ever since.
I'm told it's a great place to raise a family and, like many other parts of rural BC, a challenging place to be a family doctor.
What's the topic of the interview with the doctor on Salt Spring?
You don't want to know. It's about family doctors and how they're getting fed up with office-based family medicine.
Let me explain. Last season, we did a show about nurse practitioners doing primary care in BC and spending more time with their patients than GPs do. After that, Dr. Christopher Applewhite, a family physician on Salt Spring, sent me this. Hi, Dr. Goldman, he wrote. I'd love to have a voice in this conversation.
There are tons of details and undercurrents to this conversation that often get missed. I'm certainly relieved that the conversation has moved beyond doctors just want more money in the public eye. But funding alone is only scratching the surface of how we got to where we are in BC today.
I could have interviewed Chris in a studio, but he suggested I come see for myself.
This is an important BC announcement. All BC Ferry crew members are certified by Transport Canada Marine Safety.
Float planes are a bit of a luxury. This ferry is the main way residents get to and from Vancouver Island. As we'll see, that remoteness is part of what makes it challenging to practice medicine here.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm good. Sleep okay?
Yeah, good. Better than I thought. Good. Yeah.
Lead the way. I have no idea.
I think our options are pretty limited. Let's try Barb's Buns.
Barb's Buns sounds great.
I sprang for coffee and muffins at Barb's Buns. Chris is an athletic, muscular man who does Brazilian jiu-jitsu, loves sea kayaking and fly fishing. You can see why he might want to live here.
So I'm getting the feeling that this is a great place to raise a family.
It definitely is. Yeah, the schools are good. It's safe. Lots of time outdoors. The kids can easily go out in our yard and spend hours entertaining themselves, which is fantastic.
He's in his 40s. He's late getting started in family medicine because he was a physical therapist before getting his MD. Oh, and by the way, Chris is BIPOC. He's a board member of Black Physicians of British Columbia, where he mentors current and prospective Black medical students, something he loves to do. I wanted to find out how this go-getter went from eager new doctor to disillusioned and exhausted in just 3 years.
Should we sit back here to talk?
Sure, let's do that.
So how were things when you first started out?
Well, starting out in family practice is pretty hectic, especially when you take over a practice. You've got 1,000 or so people to get to know. You've got to figure out how to do billing, figure out how the schedule works, learn how to juggle the various schedules that I have, which is the emergency room, the office, long-term care and hospitalist work. And the first few months just feel like a bit of a whirlwind, but I think that's the same for everyone, whether they take over a practice or start from scratch. It's a big period of transition. But my colleagues were really supportive and welcoming, and I feel like I'm in the groove of it now.
And what have you liked about family practice?
The best part about family practice is the relationships that you get with your patients, getting to really know them, their families, kids, grandkids. It also feels really good to know that those relationships really contribute to their positive health outcomes. And it's just really cool to see people going through all different stages of life and to help them to navigate all that.
And this is, you've been in practice here over 2 years?
I've been in practice here for about 3 years, and the year before that I was here on and off, both as a resident and a locum.
Okay, so now more than 3 years later. Yeah. What's the mood like for you and your colleagues?
So I think people are speaking with their feet. Practices are closing across BC at an alarming rate. I don't know where the doctors are going, but they're disappearing. I think some of them are leaving medicine altogether. They're retiring. I had at one time presumed that they were going to work as hospitalists, but speaking to one of my colleagues in the hospitalist program, they're also struggling to find people. So people are just leaving practice altogether.
Including right here in this practice?
Including right here in this practice, yeah. We've had several departures in the last year or so. Only one of those physicians has been able to find a replacement, and for that reason, this island community has an attachment rate which is only about 50% currently. So almost the majority of people don't have a family physician on the island now.
What Chris just said is worth emphasizing because it gets to the heart of the problem. Nearly half of Salt Spring Islanders do not have a family doctor. Not just here, but in many parts of BC. Way more than the national figure of 15% reported by the Canadian Institute for Health Information, CIHI. Chris says the problem is not a lack of family doctors. There are plenty in BC. It's just that a lot of them have given up doing office-based family medicine, or longitudinal care as they call it. They're closing their practices to work full-time in the ER or as hospitalists. Some are retiring early or quitting to do something else. That's tough on patients. Turns out it's also tough on doctors like Chris. Talk about the actual working conditions. Like, what are your working conditions like?
The working conditions are frustrating right now because there's so many people coming to the emergency room that are unattached. There's a lot of, I guess it's moral distress knowing that these people are not being served well in the environment that you're seeing them in. And it's difficult to figure out how to do the best for them despite the limitations of them not having a GP.
That's them. But what about the patients that you, what about actual practice here in the office here? You called this area the swamp. Why do you call it the swamp?
Right. I see what you're getting at. So this is the room where the paperwork happens, and family physicians everywhere have a significant amount of paperwork to do. The burden of that has been increasing, even in the time that I've been practicing, which isn't that long. I don't know why, but you know, insurance forms and notes and et cetera have been just multiplying at an incredible rate. And unfortunately, we're only paid for visits, which is really, you know, probably only half of our work that we do.
Like for actually seeing the patient and making a diagnosis and proposing a treatment.
Correct, yeah. So I guess the point you're getting at is this is the room that the unpaid work happens in. And I spoke to my former residency mentor and supervisor about the way he practices in the city, which is 5 days a week in the office. And he estimates that doing that full-time, he does 20 to 30 weeks of unpaid full-time work a year, comprised mostly of paperwork and forms.
Weeks or days?
That's weeks.
Wow. So how many hours a day do you spend on paperwork?
So, of course, it varies a little bit from practitioner to practitioner, but myself personally, I try to get here by 8, quarter after 8, see what's in the paper box, try and take care of a bit of that. I've got an hour booked for lunch. Most of the time, I just work right through that, either charting or completing forms. I get home around 5, try to spend a bit of time with my kids, and then I'm usually up doing further paperwork till about 10 or 10:30 on a day that I've had in the clinic.
And how many days a week are you in the clinic?
I'm in the clinic 3 days a week currently.
And for the time that you do get paid, for the work that you do get paid, are you well paid?
My opinion is that no, I'm not. $33, which is sort of the base rate for a visit in BC, feels pretty inadequate. It certainly has not kept up with inflation. And every time it's negotiated, it has essentially meant a pay cut because it's been so far from inflation. I don't spend less time with my patients because I don't want to. I spend less time with my patients because of the funding model, because I simply can't keep the lights on if I spend the amount of time that I actually want to spend with my patients. Just this week, I had a mental health visit where a patient was disclosing to me an absolutely horrific trauma history. And I was not about to tell that patient, listen, your 10 minutes are up, it's time to go. And as a result, I let her tell me everything she had to say, which is extremely important for building the relationship that will hopefully help her to get well. And I actually canceled a few of my appointments that day, rescheduled them so that she could have the time. And that's what we all want to do, is give the time where it's needed. Of course, at the end of the day, I'm getting $30 for that hour that I spent with that patient.
And with all of your fixed cost expenses.
Exactly.
And this is happening in a province. What's the cost of living here compared to other provinces?
British Columbia has the highest cost of living in Canada and the lowest or second lowest paid general practitioners in Canada.
All of that, and then COVID came along. What's COVID done to your office-based practice?
Well, on a positive note, the government was able to display fantastic ability to make timely changes when it came to the pandemic. And what they did, most importantly, is that they allowed us to bill for virtual care at the same rate as we bill for in-person care. Most general practitioners would have loved to deal with simple things like refilling a prescription, maybe checking in about blood sugars, that sort of thing, over the phone in the past. But unfortunately, the rate of pay was so low that we always asked people to come in. Telehealth is now a big part of our practice and remains probably half or more of the visits per day are done by the telephone. It's great for patients and it's great for the doctors. It can be more efficient and it just saves everyone a little bit of time.
So that's good.
So that's a good thing.
But there have been some not so good things. Well, you've got patients who are despairing at the slow pace of cancer care, especially now with this huge backlog of untreated patients.
Yeah. Again, back to the moral distress. You know, you've had a patient present, you've diagnosed them with a malignancy, which may have also taken a long time because of delays in getting diagnostic imaging, getting biopsies done, and then they're told it's going to be 6 to 8 weeks or more before they see an oncologist.
Moral injury is the psychological distress experienced by health professionals when they feel that circumstances, and in some cases rules, make them unable to deliver the best care and put the needs of their patients first. It's widely seen as a precursor to burnout. You talked about moral injury. You've had a couple of stories. You've had a couple of situations recently mm-hmm. that kind of took it to a different level. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, sure. I had a very unfortunate patient who was diagnosed with a brain tumor on imaging. I consulted a neurosurgeon who suggested that she should get an urgent MRI of the brain to fully describe what was going on, and so she could have a real conversation about the prognosis and diagnosis with a neurosurgeon and or oncologist. Unfortunately, this MRI scan, which was ordered by a neurosurgeon, was going to take 3 to 4 weeks to get. The patient was deteriorating rapidly, and in the end decided to just have medical assistance in dying. Of course, many people choose medical assistance in dying, but I think every patient deserves to have the full set of information in front of them before they decide to go that route. And more that's not happening. People are just sort of throwing their hands up, going, I know it's bad, and I don't know when I'll get to see the cancer doctors, so I'm going to go this route.
And that's not the only similar story you've had like that?
No. There's been several. They're all similar. You know, they present. It's often a late presentation. They have advanced disease.
Advanced cancer.
You push and push to get the investigations and tissue diagnosis, and then there's this big pause. Oh, it's going to be 8 weeks or more before you see an oncologist. And for many people, that's too long to wait, or they just actually deteriorate to a degree in that time that it becomes the degree of suffering becomes unacceptable to them and they decide to have medical assistance in dying. I fully support medical assistance in dying, but I wish that it was available in parallel with excellent palliative care, excellent oncology services, and that access to medical assistance in dying was not easier to get than things like housing and other social supports in this province.
What impact do stories like that have on you?
It's distressing because it's not how it's supposed to work. It's not the best care for the patients. And I know, because I had talked to them over and over in those 6 to 8 weeks, how much they're suffering with the waiting and the not knowing and the unanswered questions. And this extends to their families, kids, parents, all of those people are waiting, 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 and not knowing. And it causes a huge deal of distress that, in my opinion, shouldn't happen.
We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dr. Hillary McBride. Normally, therapy sessions are totally confidential, but in other people's problems, I open the doors to let you hear sessions with my long-standing clients. This is what people sound like when they talk with someone they trust about healing addiction, parenting stress, racist ideologies in the family, and other topics that feel so timely as we come through this difficult time. Other People's Problems, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
You're listening to White Coat Black Heart. This week, a feature interview with Dr. Chris Applewhite, family doctor on Salt Spring Island in BC, a place where nearly half of all residents don't have one. That makes him kind of a vanishing breed. Low pay, a mountain of paperwork, and lack of timely access to MRIs and specialists make the work so frustrating to Chris and his colleagues that many are giving up office work altogether. And that's just the office. Salt Spring is the only Gulf Island with its own hospital and ER. Chris also puts in a lot of shifts there.
Okay, so welcome to Lady Minto Hospital. This is the staff room, our lunch room. It's where our scrubs hang. I don't know what your doctor's lounge is like, but this is our doctor's lounge. This is where we spend the night when we're on call, if we get a chance to lie down. Hey, Marie. How are you?
Hey, good, how are you?
This is Dr. Brian Goldman.
There.
He's the host of CBC's White Coat Black Art.
Oh my gosh, am I going to be on the radio?
I don't know. He's come to see the hospital. Okay. He's here to learn about primary care in BC.
Okay.
So I'm just showing
okay, cool.
him where else I work.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
All right.
So this is the ER we can peek into. So four beds and a chair. And we have a trauma bay, which I'll show you as well. And this is where it all happens, from the prescription refills to the pressers. This is the place.
So tell me about your now that we're at the hospital, tell me about your workload and how that adds to what you already do in the office.
So I'm in the hospital, depending on staffing issues that month, up to 9 shifts a month of 12 hours. And in many places, that would represent a full-time ER job on top of everything else that I do. We're seeing, in 12 hours here, between, I would say, 25 to 35 patients in a 12-hour period.
That's a respectable volume.
Yeah. And then during the week, most of us will run a half-day clinic. So
at your office?
At the office, yeah. So you'll try and get your rounding done and then get to the office by noon or 1. Sometimes you have to come back because you haven't finished rounding. Sometimes a patient will need admitting after you're done in the office. Depending on the circumstances, you may do that the same day or the next day. And then on top of that, that week is also what's called the second on-call week. So for that week, you're the person responsible for helping out the emergency room if it gets too busy or there's too many high acuity patients to deal with.
That sounds like a really busy week.
It is, yeah. It's definitely busy.
I guess you don't see your family very much during that week.
Not if it's a week like this past one, no. Sometimes you get lucky and you've only booked half days of clinic and there's only 1 or 2 patients, so then it's kind of a nice week, but those are getting rarer and rarer.
Shoes off?
That's probably fine.
Okay.
Hello. How
are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Maisie.
Hi, Maisie.
Good morning.
Are you a frog?
I'm going to do a magic trick.
You must be Iris. You're going to show me a magic trick?
Yes.
Chris takes me to his home to meet daughters Iris, who just turned 8.
You're going to make the balloon fly?
Yes.
Whoa, how'd you do that?
Macy, who is 6, and Chris's partner, Asia.
And this is our favorite part of things here, is this, our deck. Come on.
We sit on the back porch. It's set in a lush rainforest that overlooks a stream that flows into the Gulf. At this time of year, it's filled with anchovies and shrimp.
So, Iris, what do you love about this place the most?
Swimming.
Do we get to see a lot of animals here?
Yes.
What have we seen lately?
Fish.
Fish? Anything else?
No.
Who's been raiding our garden?
Oh, right, the raccoons.
Yeah.
Well, you've got raccoons as well. Oh. Chris's partner, Asia, grew up on Hornby, another Gulf island. She's also a registered midwife and practiced on Salt Spring before putting her career on hold for her family. As a fellow health professional, she sees things through Chris's eyes.
I didn't see him outside the fence.
So you're the one with Gulf Islands in your blood?
I guess, although we don't have anchovies on Hornby.
And that's where you grew up?
Yes.
Does this view, I mean, this is an astonishing view. It's gorgeous. This is part of what makes it all worthwhile.
It totally does. I try to not forget that ever. And, you know, when Chris is stressed out, it's like, okay, but look what we have. Like, do your labs out on our deck. Sit here and look at this. It's pretty special.
Yeah. And you, as the partner of a family doctor who's working his arse off, you're part of that too.
Yeah. I'm kind of taking the load of most of the household stuff, which is okay, but it is a lot. It's a lot.
So you come home complaining a lot of stuff?
He's
already done a good job of complaining.
He can be disgruntled sometimes. I think he feels like he can't enjoy the island as much as he wants to when he's, you know, has so many different responsibilities. There's not a lot of time where he's not having to worry about work.
And as somebody who's practiced midwifery, you can understand some of the frustrations that he's going through.
Yeah, absolutely. Not being able to let it go is probably the hardest part. And that's, you can only do that for so long. That's for sure.
You know, we've been talking about things like being relatively underpaid, overworked, a lot of duties that are not paid for, a lot of moral injury, a lot of despair over what happens to patients, and feeling like you're supposed to be providing longitudinal care for patients, but finding that it's like a boulder that you're trying to roll uphill. Have I got it?
Sounds about right.
I think you got it.
Yeah.
But this is a, Chris certainly thinks that this is a great place to raise kids. And you agree?
I totally agree. They're very happy. I mean, they are down there all the time. The tide gets really low, like this deep, and they will go out there for hours catching fish and shrimp and eating them. And kayaking and swimming and, yeah, roaming around. And they love their school. They're pretty happy here. Absolutely. Swim club.
Last month, the BC Ministry of Health and Doctors of BC announced $118 million in new funding over 4 months to help family physicians cope with higher overhead costs, something Chris complained about. The next step after that is to try and reform the system to better reflect the new realities of family medicine. I wonder if that's enough to keep Chris practicing here.
You've only been here a little less than 3 years, or around 3 years. Have you thought of quitting?
I'll be honest, I think about it on a pretty regular basis. The only reason that I'm doing it, and I think that most of us are doing it still right now in this environment, is because we really care about our patients. And to abandon another cohort of people just feels really sad, and it feels like a failure. But as I mentioned, many, many people, despite that, have reached the point where they just decide that they can't continue on, and they've closed their practices. So yes, I do think about it. I hope that this province can change course and start to make the meaningful changes that are needed to reverse this downward spiral and get more family doctors in this province providing longitudinal family practice.
Thinking about patients, you know, what would patients and their families be thinking listening to the two of us talking about problems with primary care?
Well, if I was a patient, I think I'd be really frustrated that a lot of my taxpayer dollars were not being used efficiently to deal with the problem. I would hope that, you know, the conversation about primary care is finally moving beyond one of, you know, the many myths about the situation, which is that doctors just want more money. More money is part of the solution, but we want more money to provide the care that people deserve.
You sound frustrated.
I am frustrated. I'm frustrated like everyone else because I can't provide what I want to provide to patients. I'm frustrated because I don't feel valued by the people that fund this system. And I'm frustrated that I don't feel like family physicians are being listened to. We have the solutions. We have ideas on how to make things better. And I just don't feel like they're listening. We've been doing this for decades and doing it very efficiently. But the reality is that times have changed in a lot of ways and cost of doing business is different and the healthcare system is different. And we just need to modernize that system as soon as possible so we can get back to doing what we're supposed to do.
Thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks.
On my way back to the mainland by ferry, I think I understand better why Chris wants to live on this beautiful island and why it's so challenging to be a family doctor here.
This is an important PC announcement. All PC ferry crew members are certified by Transport Canada Marine Safety to deal with emergency situations.
That's our show this week. Our email address is whitecoat@cbc.ca. Whitecoat Black Art was produced this week by Jeff Goods and me, with help from Amina Zoffer and Dose producer Jason Vermesh. Our senior producer is Colleen Ross. That's medicine from my side of the gurney. I'm Brian Goldman. See you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.